Coming up today, the Wired podcast team weighs in on Elon Musk's dramatic Twitter takeover. You're listening to the Wired podcast, your essential weekly guide to the future of tech, science, business and culture. Or this week, just Elon Musk. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me today are Morgan Meeker.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
This was the week when Chinese authorities locked down a district of Zhengzhou City, home to the largest iPhone factory in the world, to control an outbreak of COVID-19. Social media posts showed workers trying to flee from the iPhone factory, which is run by Foxconn, in a bid to escape harsh lockdown restrictions.
It was also the week when Britain's dream of a homegrown electric vehicle industry appears to be in trouble after battery startup British Volt spent most of the last few days on the edge of bankruptcy. British Volt was promised £100 million from the UK government if it met certain construction targets. However, Business Secretary Grant Shapps declined to hand over taxpayer money early, describing the company's management as totally chaotic.
And finally, this was the week when TikTok said that staff in China are able to access some UK and EU user data. The admission came as part of a privacy policy update from TikTok and as countries around the world continue to consider their relationship with the firm.
Now, we're recording the show on Thursday afternoon London time, so this TikTok news has broken relatively recently, and I'm already seeing lots of people saying, delete TikTok, this is the end of TikTok. Matt Burgess, from your considered opinion, just a couple of hours after this news has come out, should everybody be rushing to delete TikTok, or is this a little bit hysterical?
It's probably a little bit hasty to do that. I don't think this is something that was a huge secret necessarily. I think that the reason why TikTok has made this sort of statement now is because it's been updating its privacy policies to be in line with GDPR and all of those other sort of regulations across Europe, so a bit more transparency. But I think that people have sort of believed this for a while, and there's been reports previously that said some user data was being sent to China or could be accessed. As TikTok sort of announced this, they said that they're working to try and reduce their the amount of people that can have access to this type of data, and it's restricted to certain engineers and various different teams. But I think it just is going to continue to add flames or fuel to the flames around sort of the concerns around TikTok and China and the ability for authorities potentially access people's data from elsewhere. So it's another thing added to that pile of those discussions that have been going on for a long time. So yeah, it's another little addition, I guess. But I wouldn't imagine people should be rushing to delete TikTok straight away now.
What we're likely to see, though, as this news develops or as more people get online and send angry tweets about it, is one would imagine American politicians of a certain age and a certain political leaning coming out very, very strongly against TikTok and trying to put pressure at a legislative level to potentially get it banned in the United States.
Exactly. And I think in the last couple of days as well, potentially even before this latest update to its privacy policies, the FCC in the United States did call for a ban on TikTok, or the head of the FCC. So that is probably going to feed into this a little bit as well. But as you say, I think that there's going to be a lot more political discourse about it, but there hasn't been a huge amount of evidence put forward ever on this in terms of national security actual implications. So yeah, more to come, I guess.
We'll keep watching it closely. All right, what did we learn this week, Morgan?
So my fact this week is about trains. So in Europe, in case you haven't been following, there's been a bit of a crackdown on short-haul flights in favour of trains. So France is one country that has banned flights on routes which would take less than 2.5 hours to travel by train. Spain and Germany have discussed similar laws. But despite this, European train travel is still quite difficult and fragmented. And this week I learned that progress on some Europe train routes is actually going backwards. So in the 1990s, it took 12 hours to travel between Budapest in Hungary and the Romanian capital Bucharest. Today that journey takes 3 hours longer, so it takes 15 hours. And in the 1930s, it took just 2 hours and 45 minutes to take the train from Wrocław in Poland to Berlin. And today that journey takes 4 hours.
There was definitely a moment, maybe about 5-7 years ago, when an awful lot of European train companies started dramatically cutting the number of night trains they operated, right? And in the last couple of years, I think particularly the Austrian national rail operator has started rolling out loads more routes. So it seems like the history of European rail over the last several decades has been sort of boom and bust, if you like. And when you're talking about something as big and heavy as rail lines, those really need regular maintenance and investment over time. Otherwise, I guess you end up in a situation where stuff can go backwards when you want it to be going forwards.
Yeah, exactly. And I think why I've come across this is I'm trying to do this personally, swap out short haul flights for train travel. And it is just surprising how difficult it still is to get from theoretically big European capitals in like less than 2 days. It's still very difficult. So that's a shame. But yeah, the Austrian night train looks quite good. So hopefully there'll be more of efforts like that.
More progress. All right, Matt Burgess, your fact is also sort of infrastructure related, isn't it?
Very infrastructure related. So this week I wrote a story about subsea cables, which are the cables that run along the ocean floor and connect basically all of the world, major cities and other places to each other. So data can be moved around the world. And I was focusing on one very specific area around Egypt and the Red Sea, where there's a huge choke point of like 16 cables all running through the relatively short and narrow area of the Red Sea, and how that is a risk. But while I was reporting this story, I found my favorite ever name for a submarine cable, and this is the Polar Express cable, which runs essentially all the way around Russia, from where Russia and Japan are near each other to where Russia and Finland share a border, up in that region. And this cable goes sort of like 12,000 kilometers all around the top and north of Russia, and it's called the Polar Express, and it's the only cable that goes around that sort of route in the world.
Having read your fascinating story about subsea internet cables, I can see why that is your favorite name for a cable. Other contenders are AAE1, which is, you know, a little less romantic. But this idea of there being choke points in the global internet infrastructure, it hands certain countries, so Singapore, I think, is one, and as you mentioned, Egypt is another, huge power and the ability to make, I imagine, significant sums of money by charging companies to run cables across land in the very few places in the world where you can't just go across the sea.
Yeah, it's essentially putting these cables at the bottom of the sea helps to protect them more because people can't access them. But in a few places in the world, such as Egypt, there is basically no underwater route around or directly connecting places. So you have to sort of cross land in some places. And as you say, actually, where in Egypt, there's a lot of control from the telecoms regulator where it does cross near the Suez. And after we saw sort of like the Ever Given that got stuck in the Suez last year, that just sort of like that issue where everything was congested and everything had to go through one area is the same with the internet. The cables don't go through the Suez exactly, but the same sort of approach in terms of everything has to go through this one narrow geographic route, it causes a big choke point, which by the fact of it existing becomes a risk to sort of the infrastructure that is in place.
It's a fun story. I encourage everyone to go and check it out. But we're not going to talk about internet cables anymore. We can't avoid it any longer. We're going to talk about Elon Musk and Twitter. So if you don't want to hear a bunch of journalists talk about Elon Musk for 40 minutes, then you can probably just skip the show and go for a walk in the woods. But if you haven't had your fill of Twitter discourse, then, well, it's been a hectic few weeks or even months at Twitter, probably even years. But now Elon Musk is, for better or worse, in charge. So that's either the best thing you've ever heard or the worst thing. Regardless, it's definitely a thing. Morgan, the story's moving very quickly, but what's been going on?
Yeah, so it is moving quickly, but if we take a step back, it's basically been 7 months since Elon Musk was revealed as Twitter's largest shareholder, and that revelation eventually led to this on-again, off-again takeover bid. And all this drama basically reached a climax last Friday, October 28th, with a tweet by Musk which declared, "The bird is freed." So many people interpreted that statement as the moment that Twitter ownership was officially transferred over to the world's richest man. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but Twitter does now belong to Elon Musk. So since then, we've been on a bit of a rollercoaster ride as people try to guess what exactly Musk will do with Twitter. And Musk has almost been taunting his audience with tweets suggesting what he might do next. So those tweets have suggested he's about to charge $8 a month for blue ticks. That's the system which verifies people are who they say they are on the platform. It's also been reported that Twitter engineers have been instructed to work on resurrecting Vine, the short video platform that Twitter shut down in 2016. A lot of this is very speculative. Beyond the $8 per month charge, we're not sure which of these ideas that are being floated right now will actually go ahead.
And the most recent big news, as you mentioned a moment ago, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, London time, is that Musk plans, well, he's probably been tweeting since we've been recording, but when we last checked, the most recent big news is that Musk plans to cut something like half of Twitter's workforce tomorrow. What more do we know about that?
Yeah, so there's one thing we can be fairly certain of. There's going to be really widespread layoffs. So Twitter has about 7,000 staff right now. So Musk has been caught on camera reassuring an employee that the layoffs would not be as much as 75% of staff, which was reported at one point. Instead, earlier this week, there were suggestions it would be 25% of staff. Today, this talk of that that's going to be 50% being let go. And that might be all the layoffs, or it might just be the first round of layoffs. We're not sure. So one group that has already suffered layoffs is Twitter's top executive team, which has basically been gutted. So we've said goodbye to chief executive Parag Agrawal, chief financial officer Ned Siegel's gone, and policy chief Vijaya Gadi is also gone. A bunch of other top executives have resigned. So that includes the ad boss and chief people officer. The board of directors is gone. So that cements Musk's control over the platform. But Musk does have this reputation as a very aggressive business leader. So people who followed him throughout his career know he's not afraid of making big changes. So while we can't be certain about what's going to happen next, it's fairly safe to assume that radical changes are coming.
And those radical changes aren't just happening within Twitter's headquarters in San Francisco and its other offices around the world. They're also happening on the platform right now. So what's Twitter, the platform, not the company, been like since Musk took over?
Yeah, so I don't think it would be an exaggeration to describe the reaction on the platform among some users as panic. So people are freaking out. This platform, which was once considered this threat to authority. I mean, think about its links to pro-democracy activists in places like Egypt, Libya, Saudi. They all use Twitter to mobilize and to connect. Also in its home country of the US, it's been credited with helping spread movements like Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street. Then suddenly this platform's taken over by the world's richest man who has deep connections with countries like China. People are really worried this cements a trend that's definitely been happening for a while in social media, that powerful people have basically learned how to harness and use these platforms to their own advantage. The other thing that I think is going on, which is quite interesting, is the Twitter takeover has basically become an opportunity for various people and groups to express what they think social media should be. So we're seeing Donald Trump supporters call for the former president's account to be reinstated. People who call themselves free speech activists want less content moderation. Crypto enthusiasts want a more decentralized network. Investors are advocating for leaner operations, more staff cuts. And I think Elon is encouraging this to an extent. He's been carrying out these polls on his own Twitter account asking people, should we bring back Vine, or should advertisers support what he calls free speech or political correctness?
And Matt Burgess, something that you've been keeping an eye on over the last several days is the nasty stuff that we all know happens on Twitter, but we don't necessarily see. And it seems like there's been an uptake in certain kinds of rhetoric.
It does. It definitely feels like it's been very chaotic at the moment on there. It's obviously very hard to draw definite conclusions on the entire of Twitter and how people are using it, because most people, by the nature of Twitter and the way that you follow people, are confined to their own filter bubbles that they have created. But we have seen a marked and sort of recorded rise in the amount of general ugliness and nastiness on there too. There have definitely been people on the far right of the US political spectrum that appeared to be emboldened by Musk taking charge of the platform. Immediately after Musk took charge, there was a surge of racist slurs and Nazi memes that appeared on Twitter. Some right-wing groups that had been banned were able to recreate accounts. Twitter's team that had been behind this said that they saw this coordinated surge and then tried to remove the racist posts that they were seeing. But perhaps the most shocking thing that has happened so far was Musk himself on his own Twitter account posting a baseless conspiracy theory about the assault of Paul Pelosi. And this was after Pelosi, the husband of US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was attacked with a hammer in their California home last Friday. And the conspiracy post Musk shared was from a very well-known website called the Santa Monica Observer, which has been described as being notorious for publishing fake news. So this was something that astounded a lot of people, really, in terms of the sheer just complete baselessness of this post, that this link that Musk shared, and the conspiracy theory behind it, which really set off a lot of alarm bells for people. And if you've got the owner of the service posting this type of demonstratively false content, and admittedly, several hours after Musk tweeted this, and after a lot of criticism, he did eventually delete it, but I don't think, as far as I know, didn't offer any explanation for any of that posting or the deletion.
Yeah, I mean, the explanation in part for that posting could just be that Elon Musk, despite his enormous notoriety and wealth, tweets like a quote-unquote normal person, right? He just puts out memes, random links to things, nonsense polls. He tries to quote unquote solve Russia's invasion of Ukraine by positing thoughts. He behaves on Twitter and in normal life, sort of on offline life, if you like, in a way that isn't that common amongst people with such power and influence, which is really, really problematic. And we're seeing that kind of chaotic nature that Musk has play out on Twitter in real time now. I think someone put it quite eloquently this week when they said Twitter again feels like Twitter when Trump was on it. You wake up each morning and wait for Donald Trump's first tweet. You wake up each morning now and you wait for Elon Musk's first tweet. And both are very different, but sort of similarly unpredictable. So there's been a lot of talk this week about how Musk could change Twitter to make it more profitable. And this has also been a bit of a conundrum. So Facebook and Google have for many years been able to make huge sums where Twitter has struggled. That's partly because, by comparison, despite the fact that we're going to spend a long time talking about it, very few people use Twitter. It's very popular among politicians, among like certain celebrity groups, if you like, and journalists. But for the most part, a lot of people don't use Twitter and probably don't care about Twitter. As a result, it doesn't make much in ad revenue, even if it has quite a large influence on public discourse. And also, Twitter doesn't really have other ways of making money aside from advertising or ways of persuading more people to spend more time on its platform. So, Morgan, what's Musk's grand plan here?
Yeah, so we've heard a lot about subscriptions and moving to a subscription model. And I think that's going to be really key in how Musk evolves Twitter. So Musk has spoken about how he believes that subscriptions will, in his words, destroy the bot and also enable the platform to reward content creators or incentivize influencers, which it doesn't really do at the moment. But I think more importantly, this talk about subscriptions speaks to the pressure that Musk is under to monetize the platform. As you mentioned, from an economic point of view, buying Twitter now is actually quite a wild idea. So Twitter has been unprofitable for 8 of the last 10 years. It's popular among people like us, journalists, but investors are much less convinced. It's one of the most underperforming of well-known tech stocks. So load these problems on top of the changing financial winds for the technology industry at large. So in the past week, Alphabet, Amazon, Meta and Microsoft have all seen billions wiped from their combined market cap. Their revenues are slowing. In the case of Meta, the revenues are declining. They're all struggling to control costs. So this is quite new for the tech giants. In the past decade, they've kind of got used to constant, reliable growth. So Musk has bought Twitter, an unprofitable company, in an industry at a time when the industry it's in is suddenly really feeling the heat from an economic downturn. On top of that, again, Twitter's got really serious debt. So the acquisition loaded the company with so much that analysts estimate the cost of servicing that debt is going to mushroom to a massive $1 billion a year. So the company only generated about $600 million last year. So that means Twitter is generating less money per year than what it owes its lenders.
Now, I'm fairly bad at maths, but even I can tell the difference between two numbers. They're the wrong way round in order for Twitter to make money. So part of Elon Musk's master plan, which seems kind of sensible on the face of it, is subscriptions. How well might that work?
Yeah, so I think subscriptions will be part of that. It depends how many people are willing to pay for them. It's going to be kind of part of a jigsaw puzzle of efforts that Musk is going to try and use to make money. So another idea that's been floated is a plan to let creators charge people for video content. So a creator would be able to post a video with a paywall and choose how much they charge their followers to see it. So at the moment, those plans range between $1 and $10. Twitter would obviously take a cut of that. And I think that's an interesting idea, especially because there is quite a thriving, not safe for work community on Twitter. So right now, consensually produced adult content, including pornography, is allowed on Twitter. It just has to be marked as sensitive. So a plan like that would capitalize on that community and put Twitter in competition with sites like OnlyFans. But I mean, I think it's important to remember that the people bearing the brunt of this pressure to monetize is not just Musk, but also the staff. So one of the company's product leaders, Esther Crawford, said on Wednesday that she slept in the office in an effort to meet her deadline. So there's real pressure at Twitter right now.
It's a bit of a weird thing to see, isn't it? Someone taking great pride on sleeping on the floor of their office. But I guess individual choices. But it does show a very, very rapid culture shift within Twitter that's being brought about by Musk. And those that want to, I guess, please Musk will suddenly start behaving in a very musky kind of way, and those that don't will run a mile or be booted out the company tomorrow before they even get a chance. On the verification plans, again, I'm not very good at maths, but even if it is at $20 a month, or even if it's at $8, there's only so many people on Twitter. Even if you get everybody who's on Twitter paying for it who currently has a blue check mark, that's not going to make a dent in the kinds of sums that Twitter needs to make to service the debt. So there's got to be more stuff alongside that. So it will be interesting to see how Musk does with other parts of his plan to make Twitter profitable. But the verification system as it exists now isn't kind of like a nice thing to have. Some people view it rightly, I think, as a really, really important tool for making the platform safe for people. And Matt Burgess, this is kind of your area of expertise. So this isn't just a vanity symbol on people's profiles. This is quite an important thing for ensuring that Twitter is a safe place for certain people, right?
It is. So I think at the moment, and it obviously depends on how a lot of this shakes out and how the decisions are made and ultimately and what does come to pass. But at the moment, we've seen this suggestion of people being verified if they want to be verified, which is having a blue tick, essentially being part of those subscriptions. And I think Musk has said that would potentially be $8 a month. And that is probably likely, as Morgan has just explained, to be one part of like a wider subscription thing. But at the moment, the way that verification is used on Twitter is to show essentially profiles of note or public importance are who they say they are. So that can be companies such as, I don't know, any company that is operating and has a public presence. It can be individuals such as politicians or NGOs and charities, individual journalists and broadcasters and presenters as well, but also activists and people that are essentially in the public space. And the way that verification has worked and has existed has been to confirm that those profiles are genuine and legitimate. And I'm pretty sure I remember that when these were introduced, they were introduced because people were impersonating others on the platform. And one of the big questions that is sort of unresolved at this stage with any of these plans from Musk is whether these profiles essentially that are of or could be deemed of to have a public value because they're a public person or a public organization or figure, whether these will automatically be continued to be verified or they will have to pay in the same way that other people may pay and get a subscription. There are many problems that potentially come with enforcing that all of these currently verified accounts have to pay in terms of, like, if you're talking about governments or public services, are they going to be able to afford it if they've got lots of dozens, hundreds of accounts belonging to one public service? If they're in poorer developing countries, are they going to want to pay for those verification systems as well if they have to pay for them? And also just for individuals as well, if somebody doesn't pay to have their profile verified or continue to be verified, then are they going to be open to a lot more impersonation? So we already see plenty of sort of like scams on Twitter with people impersonating Musk, for instance, that are trying to shill crypto or something like that. And some of those have limited success, but they still exist and they're still in these places. And people, you occasionally will see a tweet that's being shared by hundreds, thousands of people if there's a breaking news incident, for instance, claiming to be having some news about what is going on in the world, but it's from an account that isn't authentic, and that can still get shared and stuff like that. So essentially the point there, I guess, is that if you've got all of these accounts that no longer become automatically verified and have to pay, and if people don't want to pay, then there could be more impersonation. And this obviously has a big impact for people in more vulnerable communities or around the world, and people that are likely to be impersonated or could cause harm from impersonating them. So I think that that's one of the big unresolved questions. Musk has tweeted something to the effect of that people who are public personas will have a little badge or something that says who they are. So it might say you're a journalist or you are the official account for Walmart, for instance. But whether they will have to pay for verification is unresolved. And also that is the only market that is verified at the moment. So if people in that space, if the revenue projections are linked to those accounts and the numbers on those accounts, and then there may be an exception for certain types of accounts, like that reduces the amount of people that originally can be sort of like projected to do this. And but then other people may start to subscribe for other reasons.
Yeah, and there's another side to this as well, which is that Twitter has historically been very bad at incentivizing creators to make a career on its platform, which is something that Instagram's very good at. TikTok is obviously very good at, but Twitter and YouTube. But Twitter doesn't have this kind of creator community that make money off the back of being personalities on Twitter, which is something else that Elon Musk might look to solve. And I'm almost loathe to mention this because it does feel a little bit like Musk is making decisions by picking random ideas out of a hat at this point. But apparently Vine is coming back, which we last saw, I think 2016 was the year that it was taken away from us. Morgan, what is Vine and why on earth would Musk want to bring it back?
I will answer that one for this time. Yeah, so Vine was the original short form video app that existed. Sort of, as you say, it closed in 2015 or 2016, around there. But it first came to pass in 2012, so quite a long time ago in terms of the internet's history, relatively short history. And this Vine was 6-second short videos that were looped. And it was generally used as like just a fun social platform for people sharing mostly viral videos of them doing silly things and creating memes and all of those types of sort of basically fun things on the internet. And had a bit of a cult following in the, I think it had around 200 million users, which is like a good number. But it was essentially shut down 2015-2016 because it was finding it hard to make money, for one reason. There was a few different complicated reasons behind this, but also one of the issues that came at them was the creators that were on Vine at that time wanted to be paid for creating their content and making videos that are viewed by tens of millions of people, and there just wasn't the sort of like structure or incentive at that time to pay people for this. And now we live in a very, very different world in terms of online creators and that sort of whole economy. Like, you see YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and all of these other platforms having incentive schemes or revenue schemes where they share advertising revenue or pay people to actually create the content that makes up all of their platforms. And this is, it's a whole economy. And whether Twitter can do that with Vine is one of the big sort of unanswered questions in terms of like starting from scratch again. While it might have that nostalgia feeling to it. There is still building a brand new audience, where, particularly when TikTok exists and YouTube Shorts and all of those things as well. It's another player in a very competitive market. And like we were talking about sort of TikTok very at the top of the show in terms of like its influence and the amount of data it collects and trains its algorithms on and all of those kinds of things have given it what would be a huge advantage over a Vine reboot. And I think some of the developers that are looking at the Vine code and everything like that, they're looking at code that hasn't been touched for 5, 6, 7 years plus. So there'll probably have to be a lot of resuscitation that goes on to even bring it back.
Yeah, it's only 2016, but in the short history of the internet, as you say, that is another epoch. And the kind of tech stack that powers the recommendation engine that TikTok uses will be vastly more superior than what Vine had. So sure, they can bring it back, and they'll probably bring it back quite quickly if what Musk is saying is anything to go by. But how well will it be able to compete with TikTok and YouTube and Instagram is a mighty big question. Let's continue our tour of all things Twitter. The other thing that has Twitter HQ on high alert is the suggestion that Musk could cut a lot of staff to cut costs and, I guess, make Twitter more efficient. We talked about this a bit at the top of the show. And one particular area of concern is around Twitter's legal safety and moderation teams, which might be particularly at risk if Musk's Twitter is to be light on moderation, if you like. What do we know about that? And how much of that has already happened, Morgan?
Yes, I think what Musk does with moderation will be one of the most interesting aspects. For me, that's what I'm finding most interesting. So Musk has said he doesn't believe the platform should permanently ban users. And he said before that he would reverse the ban on Trump. So since he's been at the company, he's not gone back on that statement. He's just said that this won't happen. People won't be reinstated on the platform until there is what he calls a clear process in place. It's not expected to happen before the US midterms, at least. So people on the right have taken this as a sign that Twitter is kind of run by an ally and it's going to become more aligned with what they would define as free speech. But I feel like since Musk has been at the helm of the company, maybe people will disagree with me, the comments that he made before he acquired Twitter have been slightly tempered. So he recently held calls with representatives of civil rights groups that represent Black and Jewish communities, groups that really suffer when people online are able to say whatever they want. He's kind of implied a certain cautiousness with timelines. He's not going to instantly let people post whatever they want as well. But I think going back to the earlier point about finances, while Twitter is so strapped for cash, Musk doesn't really have the freedom to scare away advertisers. And it doesn't seem as if he's made any changes to content policy yet. And already brands like L'Oreal have reportedly suspended advertising on the site, although L'Oreal has denied those reports. And even if the site moved to a subscription model, which would buy Musk technically more freedom in terms of content moderation, it would still need to play by Google and Apple's rules to be listed in their app stores.
Okay, so a whole bunch of chaos, a whole lot of stuff's happening. 95% of this is going to be exceedingly uninteresting to 99% of the world. But for the very few people who are on Twitter and are super invested in it, what other options are there if Musk has you spooked? Where can you go? I guess we're already seeing a little bit of that, right? People are going to other platforms.
There's definitely been a migration already of some people. It's hard to quantify how many, but it has happened to some extent. And I guess one of the issues with this is there isn't really a like-for-like replacement for Twitter, at least not in exactly the same way. So two of the primary places where people have been going to are to Discord and also Mastodon. And Mastodon itself has been probably the one where there's been like the most like-for-like comparison, because it, as a social network, you can tag users, you can share media. It's mostly sort of like text-based, although there can be images and stuff as well. But it's a bit more similar exactly to Twitter. But there's one big caveat with that in terms of how it works. It's a sort of open source alternative to Twitter rather than a centralized platform. So rather than having one big Twitter website, Mastodon contains independent user-managed servers. So people are based on one server, but they can interact freely with others. So you can essentially, it's a little bit more like joining communities, but where you can talk across different communities if you know they exist and where they are, and post on one site. For instance, if you're posting on Twitter, something might go viral and be retweeted by tens, thousands of people, and that appears in one place, whereas on Mastodon it will be slightly different in terms of where you find it and how it operates, to the best of my understanding. So it's more decentralized, and if you're coming at this from having no sort of technical understanding or stuff as well, then it's probably, there's a slightly higher bar to enter with that. There's one caveat as well, that this sort of like decentralized approach is also something that Musk has shown an interest in, and previously the Twitter teams as well behind Jack Dorsey, the former CEO, has created a system called Blue Sky, which is a decentralized protocol that essentially works in a similar way to Mastodon, where you can talk across different platforms using the same underlying technology. And that's something that Musk has shared an interest in the past, and Twitter has funded previously. So there's a suggestion it could move that way a little bit, but it's, I don't know about how both of you feel, but it feels at this second like there's not a comparative alternative.
I'm just worried that if I have to stop using Twitter, my most frequently used platform that's not a messaging app would be LinkedIn, and I don't know if that says more about me or about the state of social media in general.
What do you like about LinkedIn?
I guess I'm not a big video or image person when it comes to social media. I like text, and I end up using LinkedIn for work. And weirdly, now I'm in my 30s, all my friends are on LinkedIn and they're not on Twitter, they're not on Instagram, they're not on Facebook, and so that's where I see what they're up to at work, to be fair, which is not always very interesting.
Right. Yes. I mean, I've never really thought of LinkedIn as like a social network in that regard, but maybe that speaks to the really bad way that I use LinkedIn, which means that I think I'm connected to a bunch of people that I've never met who post sort of strange LinkedIn inspiration things. So my my LinkedIn's a bit of a dumpster fire.
But what other social media platforms do you use that's not Twitter?
No, I mean, I barely use Twitter. It's WhatsApp, right? And in real life connections, which probably makes me sound very old, but maybe I'm getting very old. Anyway, we're all verified on Twitter. We all have shiny blue ticks. Musk charges $8, allegedly as soon as next week. Would you pay to keep your tick, Matt Burgess? Yes or no?
I can't simple it down to yes or no. That's too,
I can,
too black or white. No, but I would hope that our employer pays for it. But I have been having more considered thoughts about should I stay on Twitter if it becomes, if it goes the direction that we've started to see already and it becomes somewhere that's less moderated, all of that, that will probably reduce the enjoyment for me of it generally. Like, Twitter has historically not been a nice place to be in terms of people trolling and racism and abuse and all of those things. Like, years ago we were talking about how the platform was trying to clean itself up, and it took a very long time to do that, but it feels like in the last few years they had made some progress with that and had reduced some of the worst behavior that happens on there. But now if that stuff starts to creep back in, then it's just not a nice place, won't be a nice place to be on the internet. So that would probably get me off of it.
That was a very good yes or no answer. Thank you for that. Morgan, blue tick, would you pay, yes or no?
My answer would be maybe. I don't know. I feel like I do spend a lot of time on Twitter. I do enjoy it, but I'm probably more of a lurker. Although I would like to post more. And so I wonder if that I did pay for it, that would incentivize me to post more, to make the most of my subscription, which I guess is essentially what Musk wants.
Yeah, and it could
so,
be.
So I don't
could be
know.
Part of that. I mean, you kind of get that with streaming services as well. Like, right, oh, I pay for Disney Plus, so I should really watch stuff on Disney Plus, which I thought would work in theory, but it ended up that we just paid for Disney Plus and never watched anything on it, and eventually cancelled the subscription. Right, so maybe the reason that you don't post on Twitter isn't that you need a better incentive; it's that you're just not that interested. Because I'm a lurker as well, right? And I mostly use Twitter as kind of like a version of an RSS feed to follow interesting academics and researchers and other journalists and public figures. in a way that I don't get through like traditional news media, I guess. So I don't really have much of an interest in being verified on Twitter because I'm basically just using it as a feed. If all of those people that I find very interesting on Twitter all go somewhere else, I guess I'd follow them and set up sort of RSS feeds on those other platforms as well. But if it starts to get too fragmented, then maybe that's good for freedom of choice. Maybe it's bad for people who like to have things all in one place. I don't know. What does everyone else think? podcast@wired.co.uk. Are you a Twitter super user that's looking to flee to Mastodon, or have you already fled? Are you intrigued by Elon Musk's seemingly whack-a-mole approach to company management? Get in touch. podcast@wired.co.uk with your thoughts on that or anything else, Twitter or non-Twitter related. podcast@wired.co.uk. That's it for us this week. We'll be back again next week, where I'm fairly sure we can promise that we won't talk about Elon Musk and Twitter. We'll definitely find something else to talk about, right? Yeah, we will. All right. Have a good one. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.